Okay, thank you very much, Roman, and all of you to be present here and for giving me the floor to present something about my work on ethnicity and ethnic boundary construction. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I will not be able to do my presentation in French. I speak a little bit French, but not sufficiently enough in order to explain my thoughts on these issues. But if I do somehow speak abacadabra to you, please feel free to raise your hand and to pose any question. Informative question during the speech. If I say something that is completely unknown or questionable or whatever, please raise your hand and pose your question, preferably in English. But if that would be difficult, do feel free also to pose your question in French, and I'll see to what extent I will be able to understand it. But I would suggest to keep your to keep your comments and points for discussion, especially for after the presentation. I suppose we will have time enough for that. So, but if you have some informative questions about what I'm saying, please feel free to raise your hand and we can have a nice discussion. Because I like discussion and I like interaction. Okay, having said that, I am a professor at Tilburg University, as in the Netherlands, that is, as Romana just said. And I've done a lot of work on ethnicity and ethnic boundary constructions between migrants and non-migrants in the Netherlands. And migrants, I refer to people with a first, third, second, but increasingly also third generation migrants. And I focus very much on institutional settings because I believe that the context of where ethnicity plays a role is very important. It makes a lot of difference when we talk about ethnicity in the private sphere, in a neighborhood, or when we talk about ethnicity in a work setting, in the labor market, or in a school, or in education. So for me, the institutional setting is very important. Okay, having said that, the title of the speech will be Factors, Mechanisms, and Conditions of Ethnic Boundary Construction and Their Alternatives in Institutional Settings. I will start off with a working definition of what I understand where ethnicity is about, but it's only a working definition. There are different possibilities here, but I would say that ethnicity is about the symbolic construction and patterns of behavior that are related to those symbolic constructions that articulate space and time, especially around issues of origins, where did I or where did we come from, belongingness, where do we at this moment or where do I belong, and destiny, where are we going to or where am I going to in the future. And these issues, these kind of questions, are usually answered by making use of very specific symbolic input in terms of religious ideas and notions, issues regarding language, issues regarding traditions, etc. My work is very much positioned, so to speak, in the line on ethnicity research that more or less could start with Max Weber, from there on to Frederick Barth's work and the work of Andreas Wimmer and Rogers Brubaker, which has two key points, I would say. The first one is that ethnic group formation is not a natural, but a historical phenomenon. That is, ethnicity is not something that people naturally do or naturally consider to be important. That is especially regarding ethnic group formation. So I focus here very much on ethnic group formation. Ethnic group formation is not something natural. It is a historical or sociological phenomenon, if you like, and therefore it needs an explanation. If ethnicity or ethnic group formation plays a role, it needs an explanation. So we need to look for the factors that produce ethnic group formation. Secondly, and this has been very much emphasized by Frederick Barth and therefore and subsequently also by Andreas Wiemann and Rogers Brubaker, is that crucial is not in the emergence of ethnic group formation is not the cultural stuff, as Frederick Barth said it, that marks it, but the construction of ethnic boundaries that enclose it. Ethnic group formation is basically the construction of an outgroup and the differentiation between you and the outgroup. And in which all kinds of symbolic stuff, so to speak, or symbolic input or resources are used in order to make that boundary between the in-group and the out-group credible. Very often making use of even invented cultural stuff in order to make this difference between the in-group and the out-group credible. So these are the two issues, the historical nature of group formation, but also the group formation that is driven by ethnic boundary constructions. I would say that marks very much this line of analyzing and understanding ethnicity. My own research agenda focuses on, tries to detect the factors, the mechanisms, and the conditions that produce ethnic boundaries between migrants and non-migrants. So if it's not a natural phenomenon, it needs to be explained, and that's why where my work comes in order to try to provide a small contribution, at least, towards detecting the factors and the mechanisms and the conditions that produce ethnic boundaries. I do so in institutional settings, especially in the labor market and in education. And my projects so far have been carried out in the Netherlands, but I would argue that my findings may also be interesting for other people in other parts of the world. And that is also one of the reasons why I'm here, so to speak, to tell about my findings, not only in the Netherlands, but also elsewhere. Okay, the methods I use in order to understand these issues are always a combination of micro, meso, and macro issues and levels. Usually focus on organizational level, so I do this research in schools, in organizations, in companies, in teams, etc. So that's where the meso level comes in. To subsequently also dive into the micro level, that is what goes on in the interaction between people with a migration background and people without such a background in a class in school, but also in work teams, what actually is going on over there. Also taking into consideration influences and factors that have a much more macro nature. For instance, policy discourses and political discourses that influence these boundary constructions very much. Always trying to strike the right balance between more ethnographically oriented methods and more statistical oriented methods, quantity and quality, combining them in order to get a clear picture of these kinds of boundary constructions. Because I argue that we can only grasp these kinds of boundaries by making use of various data sources and therefore also various instruments and techniques of data collection and data analysis. Okay. My own contributions, if I may be so immodest, if you like. First, I would like to introduce the fact of the idea of multiple configurations of ethnicity. There's not only one framed in terms of ethnic boundaries. There are also other configurations of ethnicity, I would argue. Secondly, I would like to highlight class formation as a mechanism of ethnic boundary construction. Third, I would argue that nationalism, nationalist discourses, especially in media and politics, may be a driving factor pushing for the erection of ethnic boundaries in schools and in workplaces. And last but not least, I will also highlight the salience of ethnic boundaries is conditional. That is, conditional factors also need to be taken into consideration in order to understand the phenomenon of ethnic boundaries, especially. I can only pinpoint some of the main highlights of our research in a large number of projects that we've done so far. But if you would like to dive deeper into one of the specific projects, that would be fine. But I can only at this stage, at this moment, highlight some of the overall findings of a number of those projects. And they are brief, of course, because time is limited. I can talk for hours about these issues, of course. Okay, let's start then with ethnic boundaries. I would say that we can understand ethnic boundaries focusing on identity formation, that is, how do people identify themselves? Second, what kind of behavioral or interactional consequences does it have in terms of socialization? And third, of course, an important issue here is also the distribution of resources. To put it simple, do people with a migration background have equal access to jobs and promotion chances, for instance, compared to non-migrants? Very often they have not. So these three issues I consider to be important regarding ethnicity. If we then look at ethnic boundaries, identity formation focuses very much on, I would call, totalizing ethnic groupism. I use here Roger Brubaker's term ethnic groupism, that is, sameness is constructed in a configuration of ethnicity, of ethnic boundaries, in terms of belonging to a specific ethnic group, which marginalizes all other kinds of identifications like gender or age, or, and that's more important, nested identities. That is, identities that are important, that are nested, so to speak, in the institutional context. I mean here, a nested identity in a work setting is the identity as a colleague and as being part of the group of colleagues. In an educational setting among students, is the nested identity here is to identify each other in terms of fellow students. What we see in ethnic boundary configurations in classes, for instance, is that students identify themselves not as fellow students, but as representatives of ethnic groups. Say, calling each other names, like you are Moroccan, you are Dutch, you are Surinamese, you are Afghan, etc. Using these ethnic categories and understanding each other as representing these ethnic categories. An image comes to mind now, one of the projects that we did in one of the classes of a Dutch University of Applied Sciences. If students enter, a mixed class here, if students enter the room, you could visibly see to what ethnic group they were classified. That is, Moroccans would sit there, people with a Turkish background would sit there, Dutch people would sit there. And if someone enters the room, everyone would watch whether the person would sit with the right ethnic group. In this case, you see almost visible those ethnic boundaries being drawn in the class, and these students address each other in ethnic terms, marginalizing the nested identity of fellow students. Here, ethnic alterity or difference with the outgroups is rejected. There are hostile relations or between those groups. In terms of socialization, that means in-group preference and out-group contact avoidance or even conflict. Disruptive, usually, of the cooperation or interactions that are needed from a professional or institutional point of view. In the class I was just talking about, the teachers find it very difficult to get those classes active at all in order to get the learning, the educational processes going. Also important here is that students feel that these kinds of boundaries are very much imposed on them, but feel that that it's very difficult for them to escape from them, from those boundaries. In terms of distribution of resources, it usually means that in-group favoritism and discrimination of out-group members. It means that, for instance, in a working team, the supervisor promotes those members of the team to a higher position that belong to the same ethnic in-group and discriminate against those who are classified as belonging to the ethnic out-group. Configurations of ethnicity in terms of ethnic boundaries. This is actually in line with the literature on ethnic boundaries so far. And we have seen quite some cruel examples of this. However, there's more. We also saw that in our research projects that the absence of ethnic boundaries, that is, you see these boundaries in some classes but not in others. You see these boundaries in some working teams but not in others. What happens in those classes and those teams in terms of ethnicity that do not have these ethnic boundaries or a limited degree of those boundaries? We saw that also in those teams, ethnicity is present. That means the absence of an ethnic boundary does not necessarily mean the absence of ethnicity. Ethnicity is not necessarily about ethnic boundaries or ethnic group formation in line with Wimmer and Brubaker, but or about imagined communities, if you want to follow Benedict Anderson. It can also be about individuality, networking, and sociality. Ethnicity is not necessarily about rejected alterity. It can also be about recognized alternity. Vital for understanding the role of ethnicity in institutional setting is its relationship to what I was just calling to referring to as nested identity. And different configurations of ethnicity are present that differ very much in terms of their compatibility with institutional demands in ethnicity. The example I just gave of this classroom in which ethnicity takes the configuration of ethnic boundaries and disrupting the educational process. We have also examples of classes or work teams where that do provide a lot of cooperation and interaction and that do facilitate the primary process of work or education, but do not exclude ethnicity. So in these contexts, ethnicity takes on a different form. And I would like to call this different configuration individualized ethnicity. That is, in those classes and in those work teams, we see ethnicity. We see that sameness and groupism is not constructed based on ethnicity, but based on the nested identity as fellow students or as colleagues. Once that has been established, there's room for ethnicity, but not in terms of group belongingness, but in terms of individuality. Exactly the opposite from group belongingness. And here we see that this ethnic individuality, I will discuss it in a few minutes in more detail, is the object of become ill of recognition instead of rejection. In that configuration of ethnicity, networking is very much facilitated and cooperation and institutional collaboration is very much facilitated as well. And in those settings, distribution of resources is taking place according to institutional demands and standards, not disrupted by ethnic criteria or ethnic preferences. This may sound a bit abstract. Let me take you to one of the classes of a Dutch University of Applied Sciences where we did our research and introduce Halima to you. Halima is a student, well, when I talk to her at least, of 22 years old. She has a second generation Moroccan background, feels somehow, and you have to underline here, somehow inspired by Islam. And I talked to her a few years ago, and I also talked to several of her classmates to see how they go along in that class and what ethnicity, what the role of ethnicity is in their class. So let me introduce you some of the statements that Halima made. She said, the allochtones, which is a rather peculiar Dutch word for those with a migration background, I have to explain that. The allochtones are very mixed as well. It's a very mixed class. Everyone is simply who he is. We support each other. No one is them. So in her class, no one is them. So there's no distinction between us and them. There's no boundary, ethnic boundary between us and them. That simply does not exist in this class. We support each other, that is, we recognize each other. And it's very mixed. And her focus here is on it's not us, the group, it's me and individual fellow students. Everyone is simply who he, not we, he is. So she emphasizes individuality in her class, not group formation. Sameness is constructed in her class on the basis of nested identity as being fellow students. And she emphasized mutual recognition. Okay, from here you would say, okay, ethnicity plays no role in her identity formation or in this class. But this is not true. Because I asked her, what does your Moroccan or your Muslim Islamic background mean to you? And then she made the statement, it's fine as long as it's part of me. and does not turn me into being part of the Moroccans. What she says here is that she does not want to be identified as a representative of the Moroccan group. She does not want to see herself as being a part, an exemplar, so to speak, of the category of Moroccans. That's not, she does not want to be turned into that. But she sees her Moroccan background as part of her, me, as she says it. That is, as part of her individual identity. That is, she uses the symbolic background, symbolic repertoires that are connected with her Muslim and Moroccan background as inputs into her own individual identity profile. So she wants to profile her individuality by emphasizing some of the issues that she can draw on from her Moroccan and Muslim background in order to profile her individual identity within class. So here, her ethnicity, her ethnic background is not about group belongingness, it's exactly about the opposite, that is individuality. And she vehemently wants to resist. She was very empathic about this. She really wants to make sure that I am not a representative of any group called Moroccans or Muslims. And I have to emphasize here is that she's very successful in her class in terms of socialization and study performance. So I would say we have a different configuration of ethnicity here, which is not about boundaries, which is not about groupness, but which is about individuality and about selective use of the repertoires that are connected to her ethnic background. She very much emphasized that she makes her own choices here in terms of she talked to me about the headscarf. She said at a particular moment I was ready for it to wear a headscarf, but then I found out that others, that is not her classmates actually, that others understood her headscarf as representing Islam and representing the Moroccan community. And she said, that's not what I want, and therefore I took it off. She emphasized that one year she observes the Ramadan and another year she doesn't. She said that she prefers, she's very fond of celebrating the typically Dutch celebration of St. Nicholas and Black Pete at the 6th of December. Because as and she wants to continue with that as long as it pleases her brother. I want to emphasize here selectivity, making her own choice, selecting from various sources, including her ethnic background, various symbolic and behavioral sources, that in order to profile her own individual identity. So we have here a kind of ethnicity that's very much different from the ethnic boundaries that Andreas Wimmer and writes about. So it's not about ethnic boundary construction; it's about something else. I would say for in these classes, it's very important that first you have recognition of institutionally nested sameness in terms of fellow students. If that's established, you have the space, a safe space for profiling individual differences, making use of a symbolic input from your ethnic or religious background, if you like, but not vice versa. So there's a sequence here. This is very similar, what we've, the example of Halima that I expressed from a Dutch University of Applied Sciences is very similar from what we saw in a number of work teams in the labor market. It's a tentative idea, but I can't prove it, or I cannot substantiate it very much yet, but it's my tentative idea is that if ethnicity is salient in institutional setting, its default configuration is ethnic individuality. It can be disrupted subsequently by the erection of ethnic boundaries, but ethnic individuality in institutional settings is the default position if it's not disrupted by ethnic boundaries. And why is that the case? Because it allows for a distribution of the various identities in terms of difference and sameness that is in tune or in sync with institutional demands. There is a structural demand here in terms of understanding each other and fellow students or as colleagues in a work team in order to get the education and work being done. Once that has been established, you have space for individual profiling in which ethnicity can be used. So unless it's disturbed, so to speak, by ethnic boundary construction, I would say this very much seems like ethnic individuality as the default ethnicity in institutional settings of education and work. Okay, then turning to those nasty, so if you like, ethnic boundaries. We found two forms. The more blunt forms of overt ethnic conflicts. We saw those, for instance, in the Dutch police that I wrote about in the article in Sociology. Often almost violent conflicts between migrant and non-migrant officers in the Dutch police force. But we also have much more subtle forms of ethnic boundary constructions that are much more covered by what I would like to frame as mechanisms of ethnic boundary constructions. These are the more subtle forms of ethnic boundaries that we found, for instance, in the Dutch Ministry of Agriculture or in the municipality of Eindhoven, where we did last year an intensive research, or in other organizations, especially public organizations. You see more subtle forms of ethnic boundary construction, mediated very much by specific mechanisms. So that brings me to the second point, that are mechanisms of ethnic boundary constructions. Mechanism, I understand the mechanism in terms of a process that indirectly facilitates the construction of ethnic boundaries without itself focusing on ethnicity. So it's not a mechanism that itself is ethnic, but it favors the construction of ethnic boundaries, boundary constructions subsequently. One of those mechanisms we found is class formation and closure through what Pierre Bourdieu calls cultural capital control in the Dutch labor market. The theoretical foundation here of this mechanism is provided by Alverson and Wilmot, by Costea et al., by Kowaleski et al., that argue that labor control at the gate, that is in hiring decisions and on the work floor in terms of assessment procedures and promotion decisions, is increasingly becoming a matter of identity regulation or pseudo-therapy, as Costea et al. Call it. The focus of control here at the gate is not only on human capital credentials, well, do you have the right education or the right work experience, but also on so-called soft skills. On the work floor, that is, in work teams themselves, workers are not only controlled anymore on the quantity and the quality of their work or on the observance of rules and regulations, such as in a bureaucracy, but also, increasingly, on the ways in which they perform their work, or, even more important, with the so-called identity or personality traits or characteristics with which they are supposed to do their work. This is what we know from the literature. What we found in a number of Dutch organizations, and this is, I have the impression, is becoming increasingly important, are the importance of so-called soft skills. Those soft skills are increasingly being used as criteria to assess workers on and applicants on, sidelining, making increasingly less important the classical human capital credentials like education, like work experience, like language proficiency, etc., or expertise or hard skills. Just to list the most important ones that we've come across in our research, that is, workers are supposed to be enthusiastic, independent, entrepreneurial, proactive, convincing, creative, assertive, at rem, communicative, cooperative, and authentic. Authentic is becoming very popular as a soft skill here. This is about what you are. You are supposed to be something, instead of what you know or what you do. So if we talk about what you're supposed to be, I would argue these are identity prescriptions, or, if you like, personality prescriptions. Okay, let me then look at what Bourdieu has called cultural capital. Bourdieu talked about cultural capital in terms of specific normative dispositions, attitudes, and styles of behavior and expression that are learned in a particular class context. They are not functional for the work that needs to be done. That is, they are not human capital. They're not about functionality. They're not about whether it's important to have these dispositions in order to do your work well. That's not the issue. The issue here is whether you can become part of a particular class. So cultural capital is something you have to accumulate in order to get access to a particular class. Bourdieu attributes a key role here to gatekeepers, those who control the gates of those classes in order to see who gets in and who's not getting in. He uses his concept of cultural class, especially for arts, in his book in 1984 on distinction and also in his article in 1986 on education. However, I argue there's more to cultural capital than art and education. Soft skills qualify for those cultural capital. They qualify as cultural capital instead of as human capital. They are about, as Bourdieu said, about normative dispositions, attitudes, and styles of behavior and expression. And their functionality or job relatedness is very questionable. If we time and again pose questions to supervisors on those soft skills, why a particular employee is supposed to be creative or is supposed to be authentic, why that would be necessary in order for him or her to do his or her work properly. What strikes us time and again is that supervisors in Dutch public organizations are hardly able to give an answer at all to these kinds of very simple, I would say, and obvious questions. So the functionality and job relatedness of these soft skills prescriptions is very questionable. That is, they are cultural capital, not human capital. And selectors at job interviews and supervisors at assessment interviews can best be understood as being such class gatekeepers controlling applicants' and employees' access to higher class through hiring and promotion. So this is about class formation. It's not about work. soft skills are the terms, I would say, on which applicants or employees are tested, whether they are good and appropriate candidates for becoming part of the class, whether they are good candidates to establish strong ties with or to invest emotionally into, whether they can be trusted, that is, whether they can become part of the social capital of the class. So then the terms of social, Bourdieu's term of social capital comes in as well. And their assessment, whether these soft skills qualify for some person or not, these assessments are highly subjective and highly arbitrary, very much similar to the way Bourdieu writes about taste in his 1984 book on distinction. So I would argue those soft skills are about class formation. They are not about the work that needs to be done, to put it very bluntly. Okay, how does that link up to ethnicity, or better to say, ethnic boundary constructions? We saw that in a number of projects that we've done in Dutch public organizations, we found that a large part of the inequality in access to jobs and in promotion chances, ethno-migrant inequality in access to jobs and promotion chances, is due to those soft skills, to that soft skills control. In the municipal organization we studied last year, we found that more than 70% of the unequal access of migrants compared to non-migrants in getting a job at a vacancy, more than 70% of it is attributable to that soft skills control. More than 41% of that inequality in promotion chances is also attributable to that soft skills control. So this is serious. That is, that soft skills control is a mechanism of ethnic boundary construction, that is, of creating inequality in the access to jobs and promotion chances at the cost of the chances of migrant applicants and migrant workers. How does that work? It works in three different ways. The first one is due to previous experiences of discrimination and the overall weaker labor market position of migrants, they focus on profiling what's secure to them. And for them, what is secure, from their point of view, is secure to them are their human capital credentials. That they are able to present a diploma, that are able to talk with expertise about a particular subject, that they are able to profile their hard skills, that they are the good person for the job. Why? Because they have the best credentials for doing the job. That's what they focus on. But the problem is, that's not what they're controlled on by the selectors, because the selectors are not very much interested in these job-related issues. They are interested in whether this person and whether the applicant embodies the right soft skills. So we have a mismatch between what migrants concentrate on, their securities in terms of job-related qualifications, and what actually matters in terms of getting the job, which is to become part of a particular class based on soft skills prescriptions. This is the first one, how this works. The second way is it takes two to tango. I mean, you can say, I want to be a very communicative person. Yes, but for communication, you need at least two persons. It's hard to be to have a communicative soft skill if you are Robinson Crusoe way with only a Friday at your side at an uninhibited island, right? In order to be able to profile your soft skills, which are most of them have a social nature, they refer to social processes, you need the cooperation of non-migrant colleagues or fellow students to be communicative with, right? So, and that's where the problem is. That is, we found, especially, for instance, in the Ministry of Education in the Netherlands, that migrants who work there find it very difficult to be proactive in their relationship to their non-migrant colleagues because they're not sure that the non-migrant colleague will respond positively to their advances, if you like. So that's why they find it very difficult to profile these more socially oriented soft skills, because it takes two to tango. So due to the fact that soft skill performances take place within social interactions, soft skill controls renders migrant soft skill performances vulnerable to ethnic boundary constructions by non-migrants. And the social nature itself is subsequently in the framing of those soft skills is denied. Because soft skills are not understood, they actually refer to social processes. But the social nature of those processes is being ignored by framing those issues as psychological or identity characteristics that would be part of the person. So these migrants find themselves in a very awkward situation that their soft skills, which refer to social processes, are assessed as if they were something that they would embody. So this is the fetishized nature of those soft skills. They understand those soft skills as something that is that stems from your individual characteristics. So by framing those soft skills as an identity or personality issue, they take away the attention from the other side of the conversation, the other side of the social interaction. It takes out of the focus the role of the non-migrants in these interactions. So the logical consequence is everything going fine? Check the microphone. It works, I suppose. Yeah. Okay. Where was I? Oh yeah. So it takes out the other side, that is the non-migrant side, out of the equation. So If migrants find it difficult to profile their communicative skills because non-migrants are unwilling to communicate themselves with them or communicate with them, the blame rests here on the migrants themselves, as if they would not be communicative enough. So this is a classical mechanism of blaming the victims, right?
Great.
Hope that's good. The third way in which this works is by way of what Pierre Bourdieu calls symbolic violence against migrants. Symbolic violence. That is, the social skills, the soft skills those migrants do manage to perform are hardly recognized. So there's an underperformance, on the one hand, there's underperformance of those soft skills because of the reasons I just explained. But the soft skills that they do manage to perform are hardly recognized at all. This is due to a number of issues. First of all, it's due to the highly subjective nature of controlling soft skills. It's a matter of taste. Some of the selectors told us that that, for instance, at an application interview, that they simply want to taste the impression that an applicant gives of him or her, of herself. So they made up their mind already about whether to hire someone in the first few seconds. The first impression counts here. To quote one of the selectors, he said, "I want to be energized by someone who applies for a job. My gut feelings need to be activated." It's a whole highly subjective nature of assessing these soft skills. It's not only highly subjective, it's also highly arbitrary, as Bonnie Uccioli made clear in her study of soft skills. Because soft skills, such as a word, soft skills are words. A word like authenticity. So if applicants are supposed to be authentic in order to get a job, authenticity is a word. But has the word authenticity a stable reference point in reality itself? Bonnie Uccioli comes to the conclusion that it has not. She writes about denotational indeterminacy of those soft skills. So that means it's simply in the eye of the beholder. It has no stable relationship with reality that needs to be done in terms of the work that needs to be done. Also, an issue here is a discursive convergence between soft skills and nationalist discourses in media and society, because both focus on the same thing. Soft skills focus on identity prescriptions, identity characteristics, whereas nationalist discourses in the Dutch media and politics talk about the same thing, that is identity characteristics of migrants, which are seen as not only different but also incompatible with something called Dutchness. So soft skills provides a platform based on which nationalist images of migrants in the Netherlands are able to land, if you like. It facilitates the nationalization of soft skills. In the words of one of the female migrant workers in a Dutch company, she said, she came from abroad, she said, "I definitely think my soft skills are questioned because they don't align with the Dutch way of doing things." You see? And also the cultural norms here aren't what they did back home. So she says here, soft skills are understood in a Dutch particular Dutch way, and the Dutch way of doing things. I would say this is a good example of the nationalization of soft skills. Also, these soft skills facilitate negative images of migrants and nationalist discourses to influence soft skills assessment. In the words of some of the migrant applicants to job interviews, a few of them said, "I have the feeling that I'm not only assessed during such a job interview on whether I'm good for the job, but also on whether I have acculturated or integrated enough into Dutch society or into Dutch, assumed Dutch culture." And what's very interesting here is that migrant applicants and migrant workers are framed as embodying exactly the opposite from the cultural and normative characteristics. That is, they are seen not as active but as passive, not as proactive but as reactive, not as assertive but as modest, not as communicative but as less communicative and less cooperative. And if you then talk to the non-migrant colleagues and to the non-migrant selectors and supervisors, they argued that these cultural characteristics would stem from their cultures of origin. They would take these values, would have taken these values with them from the countries of origins that from which they migrated onto the Netherlands. So they culturalize also these supposed lack of soft skills on the part of migrant applicants and migrant workers. Again, we see here the mechanism of blaming the victims, right? Because if you say, as a supervisor, okay, yes, this person is not qualified for the job. Why? Because this person is passive instead of active. And why? Because this passiveness stems from the cultures of origin of this person, so I can't do anything about this, right? Again, taking the other side, that is the non-migrant side, out of the equation. So in short, nationalist discourses are able to influence hiring decisions and promotion decisions because these decisions are based on cultural capital control. And if these decisions were only based on controlling human capital credentials, that is the classical way of assessing people, at the gate and on the work floor, nationalism would have had much less chances to erect ethnic boundaries in the Dutch labor market. So here, my point is, soft skills control as a kind of cultural capital control by class gatekeepers taking place in the Dutch labor market is a mechanism that facilitates ethnic boundaries in the Dutch labor market. But that doesn't explain the factors themselves that produce these ethnic boundaries. That is, the mechanism facilitates them, but that's something else than actually producing them. The main factor that we found that actually produces or erects those boundaries is nationalism. Theoretical foundation here is based on the awareness that that's the point that's very much strongly made by Andreas Wimmer and Nina Glick-Schiller already 15 years ago, 16 years ago, reminding us that ethnicity only becomes a problem in the framework of in the context of nationalism. We see the rise of civic nationalism in Dutch media and politics in the 1980s and 1990s. Under the banner of multiculturalism. We see the rise of ethno-nationalism, where Anthony Smith writes about, in Dutch media and politics since the turn of the century. So we have a shift around 2000 in Dutch public Dutch media and politics from civic nationalism to ethno-nationalism. That has consequences for the position for how migrants are being understood. That is, in the civic nationalist or multiculturalist framework, migrants were framed as people who represent different cultural characteristics. They were culturalized. But at that time, those different cultural characteristics were still seen as facilitating their role in society. Since the turn of the century, however, when ethno-nationalism became the hallmark of public debate and political debate on migration, a more cultural fundamentalist frame has come up in line with Verena Stolke, saying that those assumed cultural differences are not only different, they're also incompatible with Dutchness. So they cannot be conciliated with the cultural characteristics that assumedly are Dutch. This discourse, these discourses, both actually both the multiculturalist form as the cultural fundamentalist form, triggers ethnic boundaries in the Dutch labor market and in Dutch education. We have here two different forms of those ethnic boundaries. The more subtle form, which works through those mechanisms I just talked about, especially cultural capital or soft skills control. But we also have more blunt and more openly conflictive forms that I wrote about in my article in Sociology about the Dutch police. More subtle ethnic boundaries, if you want to classify them in the same terms of identity formation, socialization, and distribution of resources. In terms of identity formation, these ethnic boundaries only become salient in the moments of truth. That is, when decisions are made about who gets a job, about when decisions are made about who's put on a track towards promotion, who is identified as a talent, for instance. But not in hardly in daily interactions. In daily interactions, the more nested identities are predominant. When ethnic alterity or difference is put onto the backstage, so to speak, it doesn't play a prominent or salient role in daily interactions at all. This is what we saw, for instance, in the Dutch Ministry of Education. But in terms of ethnic boundaries are still there, more at the background, and they are foregrounded when decisions are made about who gets a job or who gets promoted. In terms of socialization, that means that migrant workers usually prefer to do their work more or less on their own, whereas non-migrant workers then prefer to work with much more interaction in terms of teams. The distribution of resources is de facto structured by ethnic favoritism and ethnic boundaries, but not deliberately. That means it works through, ethnic boundaries are constructed, pushed by nationalism in an indirect way, that is through soft skills control. The more blunt form of ethnic boundary constructions, as we saw in the Dutch police, ethnic groupism or ethnic identification in terms of groupness is not only salient at the moments of control, but also at important moments in the daily interactions at school and at work. Partially, at least, sidelining the nested identities of being fellow students or being fellow colleagues. In terms of socialization, sometimes occasional open conflicts break out, as the example that I discussed in the article in Sociology. And also the daily risk of contact avoidance. And here we see, in the Dutch police, we see deliberate discrimination against officers with a migration background when it comes to access to jobs, when it comes to promotion chances. So not only de facto, but also deliberate. How does that work? That is, how are these blunt ethnic boundaries fueled by nationalist discourses in media and politics? What we found is that those nationalist discourses in media and politics both provide the occasion for these conflicts and the conflictive discursive meanings with which these ethnic conflicts are fueled. Let me give an example of how that works. The example is also in the Sociology article. a few years ago, the Pope, not the present one, but a previous one, went to Turkey and had a blunt statement saying that Islam was promoted by the sword, was simply imposed, managed to spread by way of violence and occupation. That's what the Pope said. And then a Muslim leader said, "A Pope go to hell." That's what the Muslim leader said. And then this quote, "Pope go to hell," was taken over by one of the national newspapers in the Netherlands as a headline of the front page. And then let me take you to a briefing meeting at the early morning of a police team in the Netherlands. It was in the city of Rotterdam. Then when people came in the meeting, they saw this newspaper with the heading "Pope go to hell." And this was underlined was put on the on the central table of the meeting for everyone to see. And as Pinar told me, Pinar is a police officer, was a police officer actually, a second generation migrant with Turkish origins. And she said, at a certain moment, a colleague started to say, "You Muslims have to stop with all this. You think you can allow yourselves everything. We Christians will attack the Turkish consulate and will teach you what violence is." And then another colleague said, "It's about time we take the white conical hats out of the closet." And then Pina went on and said, "Well, even though I am a very outspoken person talking about soft skills, I did not know what to say. I clammed up completely. Then I stayed home for 3 months. Because these remarks by these two colleagues, non-migrant colleagues, who had put on the newspaper on the table, were explicitly directed towards her. So she very much felt threatened by her colleagues. I mean, those colleagues took symbols from the United States, in this case from the Ku Klux Klan, the white conical hats, used those symbols and threatening violence against the Turkish consulate. And then, while uttering these statements, looking at her, at Pinar. So she felt very much threatened by these almost uncovered threats towards her by her two non-migrant fellow police officers. But time went on. Nothing had been done with it. The team leader did not intervene. He at a particular moment, he simply said, "Okay, now stop and we will go on with the briefing." Ignored the whole case. Even worse, it turned out that I had to, and that's what the team leader proposed, to enter into mediation talk with those two colleagues. As if they were just boys of 16 or 17 whose thoughts still can be changed. As if this was just a joke. So she refused. What do we have here? We have here ethnic boundaries. Clear case. Between those two non-migrant officers and Pinar. Talking in categories of Muslims versus Christians. And ethnic boundaries also in terms of that in the eventually Pinar had to leave the team because of this incident. That is not only this is a clear case of ethnic boundaries in terms of categorization, identity formation, and in terms of behavioral consequences, but also in terms of access to resources. She had to give up a job. So the colleagues, what these two colleagues did, they took over key elements of the ethno-nationalist discourses in Dutch media and politics. The event was triggered by a media event, but also taking over the categories and the connotations in which, that is the meanings that were attributed to the case by Dutch media and politics. That is the categorization Muslims versus Christians, although Pinar herself was hardly inspired by Islam, and those two officers, probably Dutch officers or non-migrant officers, probably had nothing to do with Christianity. This is a classical case of Frederick Barth calls invention of cultural differences instead of real cultural differences. Taking Pinar as a representative of an ethnic category, that is essentialization, and ethno-nationalist stigmatization in terms of attributing negative characteristics to the category and therefore also to Pinar. So this is a classical example of how ethno-nationalist reporting in Dutch media directly influences an interaction that took place in the Dutch police force. But that's not the whole story, because what the team leader did is to make things worse by way of his quasi-therapeutical approach to the issue. So what the team leader should have done, according to Dutch law, is to call in the police. That is to take disciplinary action against those two non-migrant officers, because what they did is a clear case of violation of the law. This is forbidden by Dutch law, what these two officers did. But he didn't. So paradoxically, even in the case of the organization that is supposed to enforce the law, the non-enforcement of the law took place. And why is this the case? Because this person understood the problem not in terms of not in sociological terms, so to speak, but in psychological terms, in terms of soft skills. He understood the problem. Well, apparently, those Pinar and the two non-migrant officers have insufficient soft skills to deal with such issues. And therefore, he proposed a mediation in which the soft skills of those two, of those three persons, could be improved. And because Pinar felt very much threatened by those two officers and refused that mediation, the team officer was able to say, "Oh, apparently you lack sufficient resilience, that is the soft skill of resilience, in order to deal with the situation, and therefore there can be no place for you in this team." You see here how soft skills controls interact with nationalism in order to make life difficult for Pinar. So Pinar had to leave the team in the end. So this is a clear case, I would say, of ethno-nationalist nationalism influencing, pushing for ethnic boundaries. We also saw a number of issues, examples in which more multicultural or multiculturalist or civic nationalist framings and discourses influence the promote the erection of ethnic boundaries. We saw, for instance, in the Dutch University of Applied Sciences, where we did our research, we saw that those diversity classes, which every student has to go through, and those has to take, those diversity classes talk about acculturation along the theory of John Barry, for instance, or intercultural communication using the book by David Pinto, or talks about assumed national cultural differences by using the work of Geert Hofstede, that propagate the use of cultural essentialist and national categories, triggering ethno-nationalist conflicts in class. So these theories are used in diversity classes in order to, for the best reasons, by the teachers, in order to create understanding for cultural differences. But what they do in practice is that they legitimize the use of those very same essentialist categories that trigger those ethnic boundaries in the first place. So there's a lot of literature that shows, at least suggests at least, that these kinds of diversity trainings, if they work at all, usually are counterproductive. So this may very be these kinds of multiculturalist oriented approaches to training may very well be part of the problem instead of part of the solution. Okay, so far regarding nationalism. Regarding conditions, I want to be brief here because we don't know a lot about them yet. So I can't speak about these issues very much. These are very much something to be discovered in further research. But so this is about in which conditions are ethnic boundaries constructed? Are there specific conditions in which that favor the construction of ethnic boundaries, and are there other conditions that do not favor the construction of such ethnic boundaries? One of them we found, at least, is the relevance of the ethno-nationalist discourse to the primary process of the work or of the education. For instance, in the Dutch University of Applied Sciences, we compared various programs. And these kinds of conflictive processes taking place in Dutch classes took place in those programs that have a relevance to the ethno-nationalist discourse on migrants and migration. To give you an example, in this ethno-national discourse of migrants and migration, it is very often claimed that Muslims or migrants are intolerant towards homosexuality, are intolerant towards gender equality. Well, issues of homosexuality and how to deal with them, and issues of gender equality or inequality and how to deal with them, is part and parcel of the work of social workers. So once these issues are discussed in programs of social work in this university, they trigger these kinds of conflicts. These kinds of conflicts we do not see in programs where that do not have such a relevance to this ethno-nationalist discourse of migration. For instance, in ICT programs, these conflicts do not occur in technical programs in that University of Applied Sciences, because these technical issues have no relevance for this discourse. Similarly, in the Dutch labor market, we found that these kinds of conflicts are very much triggered in those organizations whose primary process does have a relevance to this ethno-nationalist discourse. For instance, in the Dutch police, we have statistics arguing, there can be doubt, but arguing that migrants are overrepresented in crime statistics. And where fighting crime, of course, is the main task of the Dutch police. These crime statistics play a very strong role in fomenting an atmosphere of distrust towards migrant colleagues. So here we have relevance of the ethno-migrant, the ethno-nationalist discourse on migrants and migration for the work that the police officers need to do. Such a relevance is not there in the case of the Dutch Ministry of Agriculture, for instance. Agriculture has no connection to this ethno-nationalist discourse of migrants and migration, which is one of the reasons why such conflicts do not occur in that ministry. You see, so the relevance of the primary process is very much related to, is one of the conditions in which that either favors or disfavors, so to speak, the erection of ethnic boundaries in work settings. I think it's about time to stop. I can talk for hours, but perhaps this is good. Thank you.